The following is a production of DifferentBrains.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spectrumly Speaking. I'm Becca Laurie, your co-host for the day, your house Aspie, and maybe your favorite TV show to binge. And I'm joined by
Dr. Kate Cody. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist in New York City at Spectrum Services, and I work with kids through adults on the autism spectrum, including conducting therapy services and diagnostic evaluations.
Yay. Well, here we are on Spectrumly Speaking. This week, we're going to be talking to Alicia Halliday from Autism Science Foundation. But before we do that, I just wanted to check in with you, Kate, and see how your week was.
I had a really good week. I was really focused this weekend on being productive about prepping my food for the week.
Ooh, that's really hard. No, it's not. I can't do that. I really do struggle. Jeez.
So I spent, you know, my Sunday hanging out with my cats and doing food prep for the week, but it was a good way to kind of wind down the weekend. How about you, Becca?
Yeah, I had a pretty fun weekend this weekend. I stayed kind of to myself most of the weekend, and I know it's going to sound weird, but I had a cold, which you can hear the end of. Excuse me. But usually people get really upset when they have a cold. I, however, enjoyed that I didn't have to go anywhere because I was sick. So I read two books this weekend, which was awesome. And I was
amazing.
Very excited. I know. I was very happy to have time and quiet, even if it meant being sick, to just read for myself for fun, which I don't get a lot of time to do anymore. So I did that. And that was good. Disappeared for a little in the book. And I came back this week. Now I'm feeling much better, but I still sound like poop. And I sound like poop. Sorry, guys. And on top of it, I'm really rested, which is nice. So I'm coming into this week really like fresh and good and ready to like be active. We'll see how long that lasts. Maybe I'll make it to Tuesday. And then in the meantime, we can go ahead and talk to Alicia. So Alicia Halliday has been involved in autism research for the past 14 years, starting her career working with one of the first NIEHS and EPA-funded Children's Centers for Environmental Health. After completing a PhD in psychology at Rutgers, she became a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology at Rutgers, working in collaboration with scientists developing the first animal models of autism spectrum disorder, capturing multiple symptoms of the disorder. In 2005, she became an associate director of research at the National Alliance for Autism Research, managing the Growth Grants portfolio, directing the Autism Tissue Program, now Autism BrainNet, and developing collaborative research programs in high-risk siblings, gene environment interactions, environmental epidemiology, and early intervention. Her direction at NARR, which was then merged with Autism Speaks, the amount of research dollars dedicated to gene environment studies was over $20 million, including the development of several joint projects to study mechanisms by which the environment interacts with genetics and ASD. Through her direction, the High-Risk Baby Siblings Research Consortium expanded the scope of the study, and she oversaw the development of a new research consortium dedicated to early behavioral intervention and launched an initiative that helped train and disseminate information on early diagnosis and treatment to the community. Alicia continues to hold an adjunct position at Rutgers University. In September 2014, Alicia became the first chief science officer at Autism Science Foundation. Autism Science Foundation was founded in 2008 by Allison Singer, and the organization dedicates itself to autism research by providing funding and other assistance to technologies and organizations conducting, facilitating, and publicizing autism research. Autism Science Foundation also provides information about autism to the general public and serves to increase awareness of autism spectrum disorders and the needs of individuals and families affected by autism. As part of the Autism Science Foundation team, she continues her commitment to brain tissue research, support of research that is targeted at the risk factors for ASD, study of differences between men and women with autism, and importantly, support of junior-level investigators just beginning a career in autism. Please welcome Alicia Halliday.
Welcome, Alicia.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for that gracious introduction. And I'm so honored to be part of this podcast today.
Thank you so much for coming, Alicia. We are going to start with some questions, I think.
Yeah. So, Alicia, if you don't mind getting us started by telling us how you first got involved in the autism community, that would be great.
Sure. I don't mind at all. You kind of already mentioned it a little bit. I was working, actually, I was doing a PhD in psychology, actually now it's called behavioral neuroscience at Rutgers, and I had the opportunity to start a new project. So I was looking at environmental toxicants and behavior in adult animals. I was looking at animals. And I had the opportunity to start looking at both prenatal exposures and then neonatal exposures. And so I started to get involved with that to look at how cells interacted with each other after either prenatal or postnatal exposure to heavy metals like trimethyl tin and methylmercury. Little did I know at the time, these are the same genes and the same proteins that are involved in autism. But fast forward a year, I got the opportunity to work on the first EPA-funded study to look at environmental factors and how they relate to autism. I live in New Jersey, and I was working at Rutgers University. In a little before then, a few years before then, there was the mention that there was there was possibly a cluster of individuals in Brick Township, New Jersey, with autism. So the CDC came in and was studying whether or not the cluster was caused by some sort of chemical in the water or, better awareness or what was it? So through that, I think greater awareness about the problem of autism in New Jersey came to light. And Rutgers University and the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey got a $5 million grant in 2001 to look at whether or not heavy metals and thimerosal in vaccines caused autism-related regression. And as a part of that project, I got to work with some of the leading molecular and cellular scientists in the world. And also, I got to participate in this larger scale study where we went to people's houses and kind of like vacuum dust to see if there was some sort of, if there were heavy metals or contaminants in dust. Again, these are kind of the same people who are studying, the World Trade Center. So these were world researchers that it was enviable by anyone to work with. I got to kind of also be a part of some of the clinical assessments. I didn't actually do any of them. I'm not trained to do that. But I kind of got to work in the field of autism. And I have to say, at the time, it was not just challenging, it was intriguing. And working with these parents or working with parents that they were just so committed and so dedicated that I knew in the back of my mind that that's what I wanted to continue doing. So I continued to do that on a research level for the next couple of years as an assistant professor at Rutgers University. Then in 2005, I got the opportunity to work at the National Alliance for Autism Research, completely switching things from being kind of an academic to being someone that worked for an organization. And so there began my journey in with autism research. And, I have to say, when I first started, I remember going to my first meeting of parents in 2005, and everyone just kept saying like, well, my doctor won't recognize that it's autism. I have to have a diagnosis of encephalopathy, or I have to have a diagnosis of a traumatic brain injury for me to receive even so much as physical therapy. And you look at that, and then you look at today, where not only is autism being diagnosed at all, it's being diagnosed earlier, and people are getting specific treatments for autism, and they're getting paid for by insurance companies. So I've really had the honor and the privilege to be able to kind of see over the past decade plus some of the progress that research has provided to the autism community.
Yeah, must have been a fantastic 10 years to go through seeing all of those changes and knowing that you were a part of building it and kind of bringing it out, which brings me to the place that you are in your career right now, which is at the Autism Science Foundation. Can you tell us a little bit about the Autism Science Foundation and what your role there is?
Yeah, so in 2014 happened to be the year that my daughter, I have twin daughters. One of them was diagnosed with autism in 2014. And I frankly think that she is one of the cases where had my mother and I not known as much as we do and been as persistent about getting her some help of some kind in some way, that she may have been one of these girls that kind of fell into the cracks and was not really diagnosed probably until later. So I don't know whether that puts me, I think that makes me lucky, right? Because she's been able to get the help that she needs for the past, you know, now it's been 3 years. And that was also the year at the time I kind of changed my perspective and really wanted to dedicate myself 100% to research. And luckily, Allison Singer, who at the time was a colleague, I had worked with her at Autism Speaks and known and admired what she was doing at the Autism Science Foundation. And I started talking about doing more research into sex differences. And out of our conversations, she happened to mention that her organization was looking for its first chief science officer. And I literally jumped at the chance. I left Autism Speaks after 9.5 years, and I still miss the people there immensely. I think the people that work there now are incredibly dedicated, and I still work with them quite a bit. But I think this is a much better match for me professionally.
So interesting that you brought up the gender research. So as a kind of female-centric podcast, we talk a lot about how gender plays a role in diagnosis and the age of diagnosis. Could you talk a little bit about your take on the gender diagnosis disparity?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it has been pretty consistent. So it's been pretty consistent that there is about a 4-to-1 ratio between boys and girls with autism. You have a 4 times greater chance of being diagnosed with autism if you're a boy. Now, that number isn't like 100%, right? So some studies have said 3-to-1, some studies have said 7-to-1. And I think some of the differences come from how autism is diagnosed, right? So, or how autism cases come into being, you know, in the clinic, right? So some studies actually go out from a very early age, like baby SIB studies, and look, you know, very carefully at kids from a very early age. Some of them completely rely on the individuals showing themselves or coming into a clinic after they have received a diagnosis. So I think that you're going to see, you know, a big, you're going to see some variability there. But no matter how you cut it, no matter what numbers you look at, the lowest number that I have ever seen is 2-to-1. And that's when you have clinicians really looking very, very hard for autism, or parents having concerns at a very, very early age, like in sibling studies. That's still 2-to-1. So if you take every study together and it's 4-to-1, even under the circumstances where you're biasing actually towards finding more girls, it's 2-to-1. So there's something going on with boys. There are two things. They're either more susceptible to the symptoms of autism. So boys may have something and we don't know what it is. It could be genetic, it could be environmental, it could be both, that are making them more susceptible to autism symptoms. Or girls in some way are being protected from certain features of autism through, again, some mechanism, genetic, environmental, both. So I think that researchers recently, when they've been really looking at this problem and trying to figure out what it is based on the data that we have, I think that a lot of researchers are coming away saying, well, there's something that seems to be protecting them in some way. And when we say protecting them, we mean that the symptoms are either lessened or that they're not the same as boys. And so they're not being picked up in the same way. There's a number of other issues that could be that aren't necessarily part of the protection or the susceptibility, right? So, just to probably jump ahead, girls may be diagnosed later because they're able to compensate for symptoms early on. We know that boys and girls in preschool seem to have the same, not maybe the same qualitatively the symptoms, but quantitatively the same symptoms. So girls may be more interested in Barbies and shells, and boys may be more interested in spinning wheels and, things that are of inherent interest to most boys. So I think that there's a combination of girls actually having less autism and then boys, and then also that they may actually be, it's not all societal or awareness. There may be something specifically that is protecting them against a diagnosis. So, you know, I do know that there's multiple theories out there, and probably in some way they're all a little bit true. But I think the predominant one is that in some ways girls or females have some sort of protection against some of the more overt symptoms of autism. On the other hand, though, they also are more susceptible to other things. Girls have higher rates of, girls with autism may not have like higher rates of self-injurious behavior, but they do have higher rates of internalizing problems like depression. So it's not as if when you say they're protected, they may be protected against symptoms of autism, but I hate to say that they're protected in full, because clearly there's issues going on there that need attention as well.
So now that we talked about the female side of autism, which I could go on and talk about forever myself.
I know. I almost did. I'm sorry.
Don't apologize. There is so much to talk about with it that it's insane. I mean, we could really have just talked about that today.
Yeah.
And so it's the reason that we do this podcast as a female-based podcast. And it's also the reason why we all talk about it so much, because it's a lot to talk about. But it's not the only thing that's going on. Especially going on Autism Science Foundation, because I am a big fan of what goes on there. So I've participated in a lot of the research that goes on. So if you could tell us about some of your projects, I would love to hear some about It Takes Brains and Spark, but specifically Autism Science Foundation is working on something called the Sisters Project. So we can talk about keeping it female if you'd like.
Yeah, well, let's at least start there since I went off my little soapbox about females and girls with autism. Mm-hmm. But this is a question that the Autism Science Foundation, and not just the people that work there, but our scientific advisory board, felt like it's an important one to tackle. Specifically, the idea that there may be something that protects against certain symptoms of autism. So it's known that girls with autism have higher social communication scores, higher meaning better. So they actually are able to probably initiate and maintain conversations better than boys are, and that may actually camouflage them. But at the same time, they actually show worse symptoms and things like insistence on sameness, which this profile, by the way, describes my daughter. Exactly. She can be a little chatterbox, but at the same time, you know, even this morning, she was supposed to go to therapy, and we have a little routine when she goes to therapy. And when that didn't happen, because she had something else going on at school, things just went completely, it went south quickly. Mm-hmm. So the idea that they're protected in some way was something that our science advisory board was very intrigued in. And also that meeting that I talked about where I was talking to Allison, we Autism Speaks and the Simons Foundation and the Autism Science Foundation kind of collaborated on a meeting in 2014 where we had people talk about different issues relating to females with autism. And we invited females with autism to come to the meeting to provide their own perspective. And this idea really took off at that meeting. If we studied not just families affected with autism, you know, we need to study all of the family members, because it seems like in some epidemiological studies that have been conducted that the sisters of girls may have, first of all, girls seem to have a higher genetic burden. So they have more mutations than boys. And these are girls that have been diagnosed with autism, that show symptoms of autism, not the ones that may be flying under the radar. These are the ones that come in for a clinical evaluation and are seen. So if you're a sister of a girl with autism, what is it? So if you have a sister who has a lot of genetic mutations, what is it that do you have as many genetic mutations? And if you do have as many genetic mutations, why don't you have autism? And there are certainly cases in the genetic literature where there's an individual with a specific genetic mutation, and the boys that get the mutation have autism, but the girls that get the mutation do not have autism. And so looking at those pedigrees and then discussing kind of the way that autism seems to run in families, we decided as a group, people that work there, and then also our science board and our board of directors decided this was a high priority for us to really focus on. And so we are right now engaged in what's called the Autism Sisters Project. And the goal is to study as many families as possible where there is an undiagnosed female, a sibling. So we're doing this in two ways. So we're recruiting new families through Mount Sinai School of Medicine. If you are a family where and you live in the general New York vicinity, because you can, there's money to provide travel. If you live in the general New York vicinity, you can come to Mount Sinai. Your family would. That means both biological parents, the person with autism, and then the undiagnosed sister. You can come and you get a full clinical evaluation and you pilot some measures on the computer. It's really not cost effective for us to be recruiting just to one site. So part of the study is to look at whether or not some of the measures that used to be done in person can be done over the computer, and then spit in a cup. So we're looking for genetic factors to start out with, and genes can, the whole genome can be sequenced out of spit rather than blood. So you come, you spit in a cup, you sit on the computer and you answer a few questions. And then you are free to go your way. My daughters and I and had participated in this for just a couple hours the other day, and we're going to go back on another day when my husband's available so he can participate. So that's one thing, but we know we're not going to get the number of sisters we need or the number of people we need to really do a good analysis by recruiting new families. So what we're doing is we're pulling in as many existing cohorts as possible. You wouldn't believe this, but it's very rare for a genetic study to have included an undiagnosed sibling. And I was shocked at this, but a lot of the studies that are going on or had been going on where genetic and behavioral data had been collected didn't include the unaffected or undiagnosed sibling. And so that was pretty shocking. And that's why we had to start with a new cohort. But there are projects like the Simon Simplex Collection, where they're really looking at families where there's just one individual in the family affected. So anytime there's a sister that's not affected, they're an eligible family. Same thing with the High Risk Baby Siblings Research Consortium and some of the other studies that collect information on families where there's a diagnosed individual in the family, usually it's a child in these cases, and then somebody else is born and they follow that sibling who has a probability of getting a 1 in 5 probability of being diagnosed with autism. They follow that child very closely. So already you have some pretty big numbers in terms of how many people we can capture that have existing information where we already have genetic information and behavioral information on siblings that don't have a diagnosis. So because the females have a higher burden of mutations, we really want to look at that undiagnosed sister to see about their load, right? Like, so their burden of mutations, do they have a higher burden too? So that's kind of what we're looking at. And in the process, as I mentioned, we're kind of piloting some measures so that this study can be done not just in person, but over the computer, so as many people can participate as possible. And we're also learning a lot about not just females with autism, but family members with autism, or specifically the undiagnosed siblings with autism. I can tell you that my experience has been, and I'm not going to speak for every single family member, but my experience has been from talking to the families that have participated in this study is that the sister who does not have a diagnosis is incredibly what we are calling not being diagnosed with autism, but being diagnosed with empathy. And they have a keen sense of kind of responsibility for their sibling. Even my 6-year-old daughter who doesn't have autism has this. Older daughters who have, especially those who have a brother with autism, seem to understand that, you know, as their parents age and are no longer able to take care of them, they may be the ones that have to kind of take over responsibility, at least for the ones that live in some sort of residential facility or living with their parents now, that they're going to have to kind of look after their sibling. And it gives them a huge sense of empathy. They are people that tend to be not just outgoing, but also caring, involved in charity work, involved in the caretaking of other people. Again, this is just my anecdotal kind of observations, and I hope that there's something we can do with collective data that we're starting to obtain. However, you know, this is just my opinion right now.
Well, I think it's a fabulous opinion, and I'm really excited to hear that so many families are participating and that we're covering so much. So I say to anybody out there listening and anybody who would like to listen, that you can send it to. Autism Science Foundation does really excellent work. Everybody's treated with a lot of respect. People enjoy going back there for work. So if you have the time and you have the energy and you have the proximity, please participate in their studies. I myself do. I wouldn't recommend it to somebody if I didn't. But now I'm off my soapbox.
Alicia, we know that you had the pleasure of attending the International Meeting for Autism Research 2017 this past May. Could you tell us briefly kind of what MFAR is and the role that it plays in the science of autism? You know, we've also kind of heard that there has been an increased effort to include individuals on the spectrum themselves as a part of kind of presenters and some of the special interest groups and things like that. And so, you know, if you could speak about that or any other highlights from MFAR this year, that would be great.
Sure. I think I remember going to the first MFAR. I can't remember what year it was. It's the International Meeting for Autism Research. And I have to say that very first year, it didn't have its own meeting. The meeting was kind of a tag on to the Society for Neuroscience. So I think that can give you maybe a sense from where MFAR began. It was a tag-on meeting for the Society of Neuroscience. And so the focus was very much on molecular biology, cellular biology, basic science, some psychiatry, but mostly basic sciences. So from then, however many years ago that was, probably like 2007 maybe, it's over like 11 years old now. So maybe 2006. From that, I think it's really expanded, right? So not only is its own meeting, which brings together about 2,000 scientists, students, clinicians, researchers, individuals with autism who are also both scientists or not, and expanded just beyond, you know, not just in number, but also in scope. So instead of just looking at things like cell biology and genetics, this is an organization that is now embracing things like policy briefs on specific topics that are of interest for people with autism. And this includes housing, employment. It includes interventions for adults. I don't think, you know, to be honest with you, I don't think that there is enough research on adults, but INSAR is definitely, INSAR, which is the society, but it's MFAR, the meeting, is definitely making a concerted effort to make sure not only people with autism are included, but that the topics that are covered are of interest for the here and now of people with autism. So that's something I definitely noticed. One of the things, as you mentioned, is that John Elder Robison, Stephen Shore, and Dina Gassner, who, by the way, if anyone is looking for someone to moderate a meeting, I hope Dina Gassner takes this on as her second career, because yes, this was the third time that I have seen her kind of moderate something or, you know, kind of been in charge or the MC. And I was blown away. I know she's going to graduate school and she's working very hard at that. But, you know, I'm going to put it out there that if anyone is interested in having a meeting moderated by someone who's compelling and interested and engaging, that hopefully Dina's available. So anyway, I went to this SIG. She's really great. So I went to this SIG, and Dina, I guess, as you can tell, she kind of led it. And the idea was, this was the second year that they had a special, it's called a SIG, a special interest group. And there's actually no time during the meeting for this to happen. So people get up, literally, it starts at 7 o'clock in the morning. They're like 7:15 to 8:45 when the meeting starts. And MFAR will give you a room to use and audiovisual equipment, because these things cost money, right? I mean, you wouldn't believe how much it costs to have a room and get a LCD projector at some of these hotels. So MFAR will provide that for you. And you basically kind of organize a meeting that probably the idea is that it, is an idea small enough that it probably hasn't gained enough traction to have its own kind of presence at the meeting, but it's definitely interesting enough. And there's enough people who they believe want to, you know, want to do, to engage in something like this, that they set that, you know, they get like 20 applications a year and they can only accept like 2 new SIGs every year or something like that. So last year it started, I wasn't able to attend in Baltimore last year, but this year it was in San Francisco and I did. And it's basically partnering with individuals with autism as not just research participants, but people that can help partner to not just provide insight and input, but can actually serve as like co-investigative leaders on different projects that have to do with individuals with autism. And so there was one example given that Teal Bienvenides, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, is conducting a study that is funded by the Affordable Care Act. It's through a patient-centered outcomes research institute that's funded by the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, let's support that. And she's partnering with Anita Lesko, who is a nurse anesthetist in Florida, to kind of think about the medical model of people with autism and what they need and how it should be delivered. So that's just one example. I know that I try as much as possible to partner with people with autism or their or parents or family members. I mean, clearly the Sisters Project is guided by family members of people with autism. But you know, people with autism, rightly so, feel like sometimes that they're treated as, you know, monkeys in a cage, that they're just being observed, that they don't have any sort of input or insight or any sort of control over, you know, what the study is looking for, what the study is looking at, how the results are interpreted. And so, you know, good for them for Dina, for John, for Stephen, for taking the initiative and putting together this SIG, which was highly, highly attended. I mean, the room was almost full. So I take that as a good sign that people in autism research are becoming more and more committed to not just studying autism, but making sure that they partner with people with autism to help them provide the right perspective and guidance when coming up with a research idea, putting it together into a study, getting input as the study goes along. I mean, really becoming partners in research. So I think that was a big step. And also I feel like people with autism are becoming a bigger part of the research process in, you know, a number of different ways. I saw more people attend IMFAR who have autism than I think I have before. IMFAR is incredibly overwhelming. You have 800 presentations and you have, you know, 2,000 people over 2.5 days. And I have to say, I even bow out, you know, like I'll just kind of walk away and go to my room for a couple hours. Every time I saw Dina or John or even Alex Plank, they were sitting right in their seats listening to everything. And so, you know, I think it can be really intense for a lot of people. I would really encourage anyone who can attend IMFAR to come. Next year it's going to be in Amsterdam, so I realize that's a long ride on a plane. But the Autism Science Foundation does offer travel scholarships to individuals. It doesn't have to be somebody with autism. It doesn't have to be a family member. Sometimes we've sent teachers who teach people with autism to IMFAR, but we have $1,000 scholarships for people who wouldn't normally go to IMFAR to go to IMFAR and listen and participate and learn. So again, I can't help that it's in the Netherlands and that's an awfully long plane ride. But if people who are listening to this podcast want to go, it's next May, and just keep your eye out for Autism Science Foundation travel scholarships.
Fantastic. Because I would love to go myself eventually because I'm a giant science nerd. So, hey.
And Alicia, I think like one of the things that you're really talking about, and I think, you know, this podcast is a perfect example of it, is the importance of partnering with individuals on the spectrum to make sure that their voice is heard. And I think, you know, having been kind of working in the autism community for more than 10 years, for me as a clinician as well, it's a really nice evolution to be able to be a witness to. And I'm really happy to hear that more and more of that is happening at IMFAR. as well as in other community settings, such as this podcast.
Yes, I agree. I could not agree more, actually. And especially with about Dina, because I take her everywhere with me that I can. She is my extrovert to my introvert, and I love her for that. But I think what's really interesting is just that whole perspective. I mean, we are a community that hears from the members that we serve. And I love that part. I love the idea that we don't have to be passive partners. And so individuals on the spectrum, you know, your voices can be heard. We are definitely making strides in which organizations are really starting to incorporate us. And I thank you for bringing up ASSET. I am proud to say that I'm sitting on the council, the community council for that. So I will be at the year one meeting. It's July 11th for those of you who are interested. It's a 1-day conference right before the National Autism Society of America conference. Registration is free. That is very rare in our community. So if you are a stakeholder, you can look up ASSET or you can find me on Facebook and I will direct you to the website for registration for the year one meeting. But thank you for bringing it up, because that did come from INFAR and it does come from the research community, the ways to integrate us in. So I appreciate that very much.
Becca, is that meeting in Milwaukee or
it is.
Okay, good.
Most definitely. It is about a block away from the main hotel where the ASA conference is happening. We did it all for convenience. So as many people that were there and could participate and wanted to come a day early could come and participate in that.
That's a great idea. And another thing I think that was brought up at the meeting is that with people with autism, some accommodations do need to be made, and understandably they need to be made. I know we try to do that. So one of the things we're doing this year as part of INFAR is Autism Science Foundation is partnering with other organizations to write a policy brief on employment for people with autism, but we want to engage as many people with autism as possible at this meeting that we can fit. I mean, I'm sorry, it can't be like a completely open invitation like you're allowing just because.
Yeah, I know. I have to have some,
it's just me over here, you know, so I have to have some idea of how many people are coming or where I can get the venue. But anyway, it's definitely something to consider, right? And so it makes it a lot easier and a lot more, it's better if there are these things thought about ahead of time. Now, I don't know about the lighting at the INFAR meeting, but definitely this year there was, I think everyone tries as much as possible to make the lighting as less harsh and as they can. Sometimes they can accommodate, sometimes they can't. It can even be things like, we had INFAR had a quiet room or a couple of quiet rooms. So people with autism, and frankly, there was a lot of people there without autism, just sitting quietly. And it was just a room that was kind of set off so that there wasn't a lot of activity and people could kind of, unload from the sensory experience if they needed to. And then, making the rooms or making the accommodations as, kind of least expensive as possible. I mean, really, not very often is our travel funds available for people to go. And so people with autism normally end up paying themselves to go, which means, you need to make it in places that are affordable and places that are easily traveled to. Now, the Netherlands is kind of the exception to the rule on this one. Usually the meeting goes East Coast, West Coast to make sure that, no coast is able to travel, too far. Some people can take the train rather than taking the plane. But the organization really does try to make sure that there are people with autism who can attend. And, that includes people from outside the United States as well. It's been very difficult for people with autism outside the United States to participate when the meeting is here in the United States. And so I think that was part of the reason that was kept in mind. And I believe the meeting's at a conference center where there's a lot of hotel rooms within a short distance so that it's easily walked to. The organization tries to have drinks available and make it so that there's ways for people to step out and in if they need to. So it's not just about incorporating, it's not just about like throwing it out there. Oh, if you want to collaborate with me or if you want to be part of this, do it. It's about making sure that the situation is as comfortable as possible for people with autism to participate. And that also goes for parents. So, I'm so thrilled that more people with autism are becoming partners in research. But I also think that parents especially those parents whose children are minimally verbal or are intellectually disabled, that they're able to continue to participate. And that means potentially, you know, in the future, you know, I don't know, I'm just throwing this out, but I know of other disorders where the event is near a, you know, an amusement park or something, so that, you know, the siblings can be there and that parents can participate and make kind of a family vacation out of it. So we haven't gotten that far yet, but definitely I just want to point out, it's not just about, you know, making it so that the topic area is accessible, right? And that there's not just talking about genes and mouse models, and that you're talking about topics that people with autism have experience, direct experience with, but that the environment itself becomes, you know, it's done in a way so that people can actually participate and be a part of it.
It's very important that we start doing those things. I know I recently saw something about it, actually exactly that topic of accommodations at conferences in the news recently. It's something that I've done a little bit of talking about to people, but I'm glad to see that there's movement about it, because it can be hard. It's a lot of information, and it's a lot of important information when you're at a conference. And I always say it's a lot of talking and not a lot of doing that happens, but you hope that when people leave, they do the doing. And so, you know, it's important that we all participate. I think we, as humans, we like to complain a lot about the things that we don't have instead of taking advantage of what we do have. And so if you have things, something to complain about, go somewhere and complain about it. Like, go participate. So that's what I do. And that's, I think that that's great that we're making it as comfortable as possible for individuals on the spectrum to be a part of their own community. And the research is part of it to do. It's ours. It's our obligation.
Alicia, could yes. you tell our listeners how they can find out more about the work that you're doing or where to find more information about you?
Absolutely. So you can go, the organization is the Autism Science Foundation. The website is www.autismsciencefoundation.org. We are also on Facebook, on Twitter. We are on Instagram, I think. And I think we're on Pinterest, but I think we mostly focus on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can definitely reach me if anyone has a pen and a piece of paper. I'll give you my email address. It's my name's Alicia Halliday again, and the email address is AHALLAY, Alicia Halliday, @autismsciencefoundation.org. And that's all one word. There's no underscores or anything. And I look forward to hearing from you. I strive and I try to reply to every email I get within one day, but honestly, that doesn't always happen. So I will get back to you. If you don't hear from me, send me another email. I really do. That's my favorite part of my job, actually, is talking to people in the public and hearing about what they think and how they feel and, you know, what they think of different science and what they're doing. I also have a podcast. It's very short. It's weekly. It's only about science. So it covers some new scientific findings, and I hope to put it in perspective for people who may not have gotten a PhD. I hope I do a good job of that. And it's on iTunes, and it's the Autism Science Foundation weekly podcast. So if you want to listen to that, please do.
Please do. I listen to it. Oh. I listen.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we're going to move on now to some sleep hygiene stuff. So, Kate, I think we should, maybe I'll explain it a little bit, because we used to do a segment here in this little section of the podcast, which always is the news. We kind of review the news, but we had wanted to kind of expand the idea and do some kind of other segments in this area. So we're going to try out here today a little bit of a tips and tricks kind of segment that has no name yet. And kind of give you a perspective on something that's important in the community and maybe some ideas about what you can do if it's something you're struggling with. So today we're going to cover sleep hygiene, which I think is, I cannot tell you. If I talk about mindfulness enough, I do that a lot. I will talk about sleep hygiene just as much. It is something that I struggle with so much. The volume in my brain does not allow for sleep to happen normally or easily. And so I struggle a lot, and using something called sleep hygiene, which is an odd way to talk about it, I guess, has been the thing that's really sort of set me into a comfortable sleep routine at night, and being able to give my body and brain the rest that it needs. So I actually saw, the reason I even decided on this topic was because there were back-to-back two articles in the news about sleep hygiene and the issues that children on the spectrum have with sleep and the issues that adults also have with sleep on the spectrum. And I don't believe we know any science about why we struggle. I can kind of guess why I struggle with sleep, but I don't know that that's the same for everybody else. I know for me, as somebody who struggles a lot with my sensory issues and sensory processing, on a day that I've had a lot of sensory integration happening, where I've been someplace very loud, or it's been a day where I had to do a lot of social and a lot of people work, and my senses got kind of jumbled with that and information, those are the days that I really struggle to turn my brain off and get to sleep, and also to sleep well. I often dream a lot more and vividly on those days. So that's what I find. And in an effort to do something about it, I sort of tackled the big things in sleep, which for me, I was doing a lot on my phone, and a lot of us do that. I was eating at weird hours, snacks and things, and a few other little things that I decided to work on. For me, the setting of the routine of, like, this is the time I go into my bedroom and sleep is the mission, was really important. Saying to myself at a certain time, no devices. It's a kind of, like, especially now, I have to really pull myself away from social media and other conversations. And I really had to sort of look at it like, look, sleep is my job. If I don't sleep at night, it's as important as eating and going to the bathroom is during the day. I have to take care of myself. And I really noticed a difference in my symptomology when I started to really practice good sleep.
Becca, did anyone ever kind of talk to you about using sleep logs?
No, that was something I actually inadvertently did it myself, because I'd had migraines my whole life, and we always did migraine logs. I always had to do those. So I kind of moved that over to sleep, and then I did eventually hear about them, but I hadn't really officially done one.
Yeah. So for anyone who's having kind of difficulties with sleep, or a hard time either falling asleep or waking up in the middle of the night, and having difficulty going back to sleep, really, one of the kind of first steps is to utilize a sleep log, and a sleep log should consist of a variety of things. It's not just about documenting your sleep or the hours that you're asleep. It should also be really accounting for your caffeine intake, your screen time, what activities you're doing before you are attempting to go to sleep, how often you're in your bed. A lot of the sleep hygiene research really shows that you know, being in bed should really only occur when you need to go to sleep, because that kind of conditions your body to be ready for sleep when you get into bed, as opposed to if you're sitting in your bed for a range of activities, then it doesn't necessarily hold that same conditioning effect any longer. It should also account for any medications that are being taken and the time that they're being taken, because there are many medications that can actually be stimulating and prevent one from falling asleep. And it should also account for exercise. There is a definite link between people who exercise during the day. They often are more likely to have improved sleep patterns. And so really, maintaining a sleep log looks at all of these different behaviors and kind of aspects of one's functioning during the day, and to start to draw some correlations between daytime activities and the ability to fall asleep. And there's, you know, all you have to do is Google sleep logs, and you can find a range of PDFs available for free that can be really helpful tools. And then even with using improved sleep hygiene techniques by oneself, if you're still experiencing really significant sleep dysregulation issues, then really the next kind of step would be working with a CBT therapist who actually specifically targets sleep hygiene issues. And they would also know when it might be appropriate to refer you for a sleep study to make sure that there's not something else going on medically that could be impacting the quality of one's sleep.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of as you were talking about it, I'm like, wow, it really is. It's just such an endless issue, sleep. It's something that we all need. It's something that I know I crave more of all the time, and especially good sleep. And I just think it's so, I think everyone should really sort of now in this day and age really needs to create a sleep routine, because we can't, we're constantly bombarded with information. And I think, you know, that the whole idea of, you know, laying in your bed, and that's, you know, that starts the whole reaction for your body to biologically prepare to go to sleep. It's, you know, it's working off of Pavlov's basic concept. So that, what I did in that case, I noticed or had to pay attention to the fact that I was, as my work became more work at home, and as I was bringing my computer around with me more, I was doing more and more work in bed. And that was really one of the first things that I had to pull out. It was like, nothing else happens in the bedroom but sleep. So no working in there, no eating in there, no, you know, playing video games in there if you have someplace else that you can do it. Kind of just pulling everything out of the bedroom besides what belongs in the bedroom was very helpful. And it was part of creating boundaries, which creating healthy boundaries for me was a big one. We could do a whole episode on that. But that was one of my healthy sleep boundaries. It was like, no, this is the time when I won't answer emails anymore. When if you send me an email, that's fine. It's not going to bother me, but you're not going to hear from me after a certain time of night. You know, nothing after 9 p.m. is sort of what I do for my rule. I try to keep to it as much as I can. Because it was essential to kind of say, no, hey, if I want to sleep in this room, I shouldn't be doing anything else in here. I don't go to the kitchen to go to sleep.
Right.
So, right. So it was that blatantly obvious. Like, why was I doing all of these really foolish things and not helping myself through sleep? I love the difference in really good sleep. And so that for me came, especially, you know, we talk within autism, we're like, oh, okay, take advantage of your take advantage of your strengths, and, you know, we'll deal with the challenges after. So when I'm taking, you know, my sleep into account, well, I follow rules probably better than anybody. Once I have a routine and a habit, and I know it's part of my routine, that's it. It's in. So for us on the spectrum, it's sort of almost easy, second nature, to integrate a new rule in. And once a rule is in place, it's sort of pretty easy for us to follow it when it's working. So that was the first easy thing to integrate, and it really was making this huge difference. I think for me, guiltily, the hardest part is definitely the phones down, you know, no technology game after 9 o'clock was very hard to kind of integrate. But doing it was very helpful. So that if I am on my phone, you know, it's for games or for reading or something other than, you know, actively engaging with the planet. Was important. And then I think also too, I don't know, I did a lot of reading about sleep hygiene, and I found that it's important to sleep the right amount of hours and all of that stuff. But I know that varies a lot for people on the spectrum. And
well, and a lot of like the amount of sleep that people need is really contingent on, you know, a range of different factors. And so if a person has, let's say, a co-occurring autoimmune condition, you're probably more likely to need a little bit more sleep than someone who doesn't experience those health issues. So I think there's a range of kind of medical factors that can impact how much sleep is needed. And it is truly individualized, but it's about creating that routine and that schedule that works with your individual needs to then be able to have improved sleep patterns, which can really, you know, optimize everyday functioning across the board, because sleep really is connected with how our brains operate, and being able to, you know, maintain regular sleep. And it can impact mood, it impacts, you know, nutrition, it can impact the way a person is available to socialize in terms of being present with others. And so, and that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of how sleep can impact those everyday aspects of functioning. And so I think, yeah, the more you kind of know yourself, and the more you kind of research, you know, how different approaches to sleep hygiene, I think the more likely a person is to be able to kind of create that individualized routine that will, you know, optimize their functioning.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's really important self-care, I think, sleep, proper sleep, good sleep. It's part of that self-care umbrella. So take a little chapter and for yourselves and kind of think about what you're doing in terms of sleep. Figure out, you know, if you're not sleeping well, why? You know, what may be the things that are kind of, are there noises? Are you doing technology too much? Are you stressed about something? All of those things affect our sleep, and it's important. It's another good time of day and another way to check in with yourself if things are kind of okay or if you're not doing really good self-care. So we'll just add that under the self-care umbrella, and I guess we'll wrap it up for now. We'll cover another segment like this coming up soon, I hope. So we'll once again say thank you guys for listening to Spectrumly Speaking. Thank Dr. Halliday for being on today and sharing all of that good science stuff with us. Please follow her. Our podcast is excellent if you want some science news regularly, and you can definitely find her at ASF. Keep up with their doings. They're always doing good stuff. And she offered her email, so feel free to email her if you have a question. I myself can be found on Facebook or LinkedIn or at my website, which is www.beccalaurie.com. And we are produced by Different Brains, so you can check out their website, differentbrains.com, and their Twitter at DiffBrains.
Yes, and I can be found at spectrumservicesnyc.com. I'm also available via email at katherinecodysidy@gmail.com. Please make sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and don't hesitate to send us questions to spectrumlyspeaking@gmail.com, and we will answer them on future shows, and we'll keep our conversation going.
We'll see you guys next week. Thanks for listening.
Spectrumly Speaking is a production of Different Brains. For more information, visit us at differentbrains.com.